This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes... These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Back to court in the Brian Koberger case, a hearing just taking place just the other day. Not with, fireworks, but a pretrial rulings that quietly decide what the jury will actually get to hear when things finally go to trial. We're talking about Amazon purchase histories, 911 call audio, surviving roommate testimony, and whether bushy eyebrows are legally significant enough to tip a murder case. And just to make things even trickier, we've got autism, alibis, and the death penalty all tangled up into this legal chess match. So with all of these evidentiary decisions still hanging in the balance, we brought in someone who knows exactly how these courtroom rules shape a case, former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis. Now, Eric, when a judge is making all of these pretrial calls about the jury, what they can and what they can't hear, especially in a death penalty case like this, how much does that shape the outcome before a trial even begins?
It really installs parameters for the case. You know, there's all this information we've heard about the case, but only some of that is going to be legally admissible. It puts up some guardrails, kind of. So the judge can ensure that the case doesn't go completely off the rails with, you know, conspiracy theories or evidence that is not legally competent and admissible. And so it really sort of shapes what the jury is going to hear and affects the strategy on both sides based on what those pretrial rulings will be.
And there's a lot of thing. I mean, basically, Ann Taylor went through the laundry list of trying to get everything excluded and saw what stuck. I was kind of like, it's funny watching her. She's a great attorney. But I feel like sometimes it's like watching like my daughter, like try and tell me something and then stand back and wait. Like, what are they going to say? Is he going to say, can I go to the sleepover tonight? Can I do this? Can I do that? And then you wait for the response. It's like, okay, What about this? What if I do it this way? That's kind of how it feels like it's kind of coming about. But I don't blame her. She's doing her job. 911 call. That was one of the things that the defense, of course, wanted excluded. They tried to keep it that emotional 911 call from the surviving roommates out due to hearsay. The judge said most of it qualifies under an exception here, under the excited utterance exception. Can you explain that to me a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. So the general rule is that hearsay, out-of-court statements, do not get to be admitted to trial, but there are exceptions. One is excited utterance. So what that means is that if a person was under such a distressing or excitable set of circumstances that they uttered something, the rationale is that it's more likely than not that that would be a true statement, just because it's spontaneous. It's just coming out of them based on sort of what they're being affected by. They don't have time to strategize and contemplate it and manipulate it or fabricate things. And so that is the exception that 911 calls are often let in under. And I think it was certainly the right call to let this one in. I think it's relevant and the jury needs to hear it.
Yeah, I felt like it was a stretch to say that the 911 call on this very case, we don't want that in there. That's not appropriate. I know they were also trying to argue terms as well, like murder. It's like, it's what he's charged with. But somehow they thought, well, the jury could get some impression that he's a murderer and he's not yet convicted of it. Like, well, he's charged with murder. Again, was that a stretch where they're trying to argue like words of murder should not be in a trial like this or shouldn't can only be used in certain contexts?
You know, words have a serious effect, including on jurors. They can be evocative. They can conjure up ideas and notions and other events that aren't related to the trial. So oftentimes the defense will seek to limit verbiage that can be used. Another one that's common is when they try to eliminate the use of the word victim, because at this point it's an alleged victim and victim just has sort of an emotionally charged concept that's attached to it. That being said, murder is the charge, man. And so of course the jury's going to hear about that, and judges aren't usually inclined to, you know, really police the language used by both sides.
Murder was the case that they gave him. So it's kind of, it's not shoplifting.
That's Snoop Dogg. Yeah,
exactly. Murder was the case. Another one, psychopath, sociopath. The judge agreed on this one. I'm interested as to how and why they were so concerned about these terms being introduced when the prosecution, he was like, we're not really planning on doing that to begin with, because it's not really contextually part of the case. But I mean, I get it. You don't want those terms out there. But I mean, are they? It seems like there's something else behind the curtain here that we don't know about yet, that they're very concerned could come to light. So the judge is banning the terms to prevent the jury. But what if there is something out here? I mean, is there a way? Is there some sort of diagnosis? Is there some sort of evaluation that puts them into those categories? And if there is, like scientifically, medically, I would think that that could be used if that's there.
That would be a very intuitive take on it, certainly. And, you know, I'm not privy to all of the evidence in this case, but more than likely there is mental health information contained within that, you know, large swath of evidence. I think defense is worried that terms like psychopath and sociopath, you know, we start thinking about, you know, raped serial killers and things like that. And if that is attached to the defendant, that of course could have a prejudicial effect. The jury could say, hey, you know, I don't know if the evidence is here, but if this guy's a psychopath, I don't want him out in my streets. I'm going to convict him in part on that basis. That would be improper, and that could result in a reversal of the conviction. And so I think it is prudent to try to exclude such inflammatory terms like that.
Could those terms be used in the sentencing phase of the trial? If he's found guilty, obviously you wouldn't get to a sentencing phase without it, but if he's found guilty, I mean, you can't just like throw it around for fun, but I mean, could it be used there if there is, I mean, he's found guilty and you killed all those people? I mean, that's kind of psychotic. Or is he just banning it from the trial portion of the of the case.
What it sounds like is those terms are just being banned from the guilt phase of the death penalty trial. If Koberger is convicted, there'll be a penalty phase at which the jury will decide whether Koberger should be put to death or not. And at that phase, things open up substantially. There's a lot more information that is admissible at the penalty phase that wouldn't be admissible at the guilt phase, because the question is broader. The question is, really, does this guy deserve death? And so, you know, could one side propose that a mental health expert has diagnosed somebody as a psychopath or sociopath if that has happened? You know, I think they could certainly offer that. The judge would have to be careful, but that type of information, especially as it relates to whether a person might commit a crime later or is a violent risk to society, even in prison, that information is relevant at a penalty phase.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where sometimes less is more. If they've already sunk their ship over here, you don't need to keep, you know, shooting cannonballs at it. If it's already down. Another term that they had some issue with here, the defense had issue, is touch DNA. I mean, it's been a key part of all of this. It's a key piece of evidence. And it's not a defamatory term. It's just, it's a definition term of what it is, of the type of DNA that they found on the knife sheath. The judge ultimately ruling the jurors can handle understanding that term. What is the argument on that one of from the defense as to why that term would be, I guess, defamatory or something that would sway a jury one way or another?
You know, one is that it's hurtful to my case. That's ground the defense is probably thinking about. You know, I think what they're trying to say is they've been attacking the DNA and the way the DNA analysis was conducted from very early on in this case. And this is just another argument trying to chip away at the state's DNA evidence. But touch DNA is a very common concept. It comes up in nearly any case in which DNA is implicated. I've never seen a judge exclude it. I think if it comes into evidence, the jury could infer that, oh, that means he must have touched these things like the knife sheath, and it came back to him and his DNA. And that's really problematic for them.
Another problematic thing is the alibi, the stargazing, which it was cloudy that night. But you know, one can say I usually go out and stargaze. You probably, you know, a pattern of behavior would be nice to see on that through something to show that this is, you know, a regular thing for him. I don't know that they have that. But they are saying that if you're going to use the I was out looking at stars defense, then you get to testify. That's the point of entry. Must be this tall to ride the ride if you're going to go down that road. Or if it's, we have some sort of witness corroborating this, which I would think if they had that, they would already have been talking about that by now. Is this going to get Koberger on the stand? Do you think it's something that's important enough that they need to have an alibi in this case? Or is it on their part, less is more, because it could lead to too many other offshoots that are not going to be beneficial to Koberger?
Koberger's attorney is in a dilemma on this alibi thing, because in order for information to go to the jury, you have to have someone testify who has personal knowledge of that information. The only person who would have personal knowledge of whether Koberger was out driving around looking at the stars is Koberger. There's no insinuation that there was somebody who was riding with him that no one has heard about. You know, even if Koberger talked about later doing stargazing or whatever, that would be a prior consistent statement. But I think in order to get the alibi itself in front of the jury, Koberger's got to take that stand. And that opens up a number of risks and contingencies that are really troubling and exciting if you're a legal expert and things like that.
I mean, that's the only alibi they've ever presented. Is that simply because they can't produce any other sort of alibi? There's nobody else to talk to. We know that. But why not? Like, yes, you got him. The cell data shows he's driving around. That's his alibi. He was moving around. The only data you don't have is between those hours. But he was driving around. It clearly shows. It turns back on, and he was driving around later. I mean, could they go down some sort of road there of, clearly, you see he was driving. The phone went off. Has your phone ever died? Your phone ever turned off? But again, they can look at the data on the phone and say, Here's your phone. Literally, it was shut off. The battery didn't die. There isn't much of an alibi here. How important is that going to be to have an alibi in a case like this? It seems pretty important to say what the hell you were doing and just conveniently you disappear from the map during those hours.
You know, this case is kind of a whodunit. And so what that means is the defense has to try to show, hey, it wasn't my guy. But in order for them to do that, like you said, there could be cell phone analysis saying that he was driving around at some point. But that doesn't get us to the inferential leap of he was, you know, doing this habit that he does driving around stargazing. In order for that specific information to come into the jury, someone's got to testify about that. Now, would the judge allow some latitude for defense in a closing argument to sort of drum up some conclusion based on the cell phone coordinates and stuff like that? Possibly, but usually for an alibi, you've got to meet an evidentiary standard before it will even go to the jury. And I'm not sure simply cell phone locational data gets you to, oh, he was driving around looking at stars because this is what he does. And he's just an innocent dude.
Was it a mistake for the defense to introduce the autism alleged diagnosis? Because as far as I know, we don't have any proof that that's there, that he actually has the diagnosis. I would assume if you're going to introduce it, there's got to be some medical record to back it up. Would there not? I mean, if you're going to say this out loud in court that he has autism, he's been diagnosed with autism, you can't just like self-diagnose yourself with autism. I mean, for it to be relevant. So let's assume there is an autism diagnosis somewhere in his history. Does that help or hurt it? Because to me, when I saw that, that's kind of damning. Like, this doesn't sound like it's going to help you in any way, shape, or form, unless you're simply trying to use that for the penalty phase of this to not get the death penalty because you're somehow mentally inept and you couldn't control what you were doing, which clearly is not the case. But I don't know if they thought that, I don't know what they thought with introducing this, because it doesn't necessarily lean to you're less likely to do this. To me, it leans like you might be more likely because, again, not everybody on that spectrum doesn't have empathy, but there's some that do. There's places on that spectrum where you are missing that. That's just your genetics. That's how you operate. Doesn't make you a killer. But it is a struggle for many people to try and feel that empathy when they can't. And Koberger's already shown a tendency to not have it, even wrote about not having it. So was that a wise move to add that into the lexicon here, even though the judge has ruled that autism can't be used as an aggravating factor in the death penalty?
Yeah, Tony, I think the jury's still out on that one. You know, number one, it absolutely would have to be presented by an expert who has knowledge of that diagnosis of Koberger and can substantiate that. Number two, who cares? How does that relate to the case?
Yeah.
The defense is going to have to identify some kind of specific symptoms of autism spectrum disorder that Koberger had that somehow makes it less likely he did this or at the penalty phase makes it less likely or makes him less blameworthy for his conduct. And you know, autism spectrum disorder, my understanding is a broad panoply of different symptoms. And I just think it's a bit vague and speculative and I don't see how it's going to give them a leg up at either phase of the game.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it would be like saying, and he loves to collect knives. Okay, like, so just so he's a collector and it just happens that he has, I mean, I'm just making that up. They're not saying that, but it was like a statement like, ooh, maybe you should have thought about that one a little bit more before you brought that into the lexicon of everything here. Koberger's family, the talk is that some may be blocked from viewing the trial until they've testified. Number one, how common is it to see a family member testify against their own son or their brother in a death penalty trial and testifying against that individual? What do you think we could see happen here? What sort of rights do they have if they do take the stand? Can they take the fifth and just not talk? Or what can they do if they're on the stand? They may want to talk.
Yeah, you know, it's not terribly common to have a family member testify against their own family, but it certainly happens. Depends on the nature of the case. One thing is that the family member likely doesn't have much say in whether they have to testify or not. If the prosecution subpoenas them, then they will have to take that stand. Now, can they assert the Fifth? Perhaps they could, but the implication from that is that there was some sort of criminal legal liability that could be attached to their responses to questions. Does that color things in an even more negative fashion for Koberger if someone gets up there and takes the Fifth? Now, different judges have different policies on whether someone could take the Fifth in front of a jury, but I think there are questions that to which the Fifth doesn't apply. Simply questions about Koberger, about what he's like, about that might undermine the defense. Those things, it wouldn't be appropriate for a family member to say, "I plead the Fifth to protect myself." Where you don't have any criminal risk when it comes to those questions.
And I guess that's kind of leads to my next question of, I mean, what sort of things can the prosecutor ask the family that is going to be relevant to the case? Obviously, questions about his demeanor when he returned to Pennsylvania, questions about that car ride with the dad, things within that context of that bubble, of that time span right there. Can they also go back further? Can they go back to, like, childhood? Can they ask, what was he like as a kid? What sort of things did you observe back then? You know, when he was diagnosed with autism, why, you know, what were the signs that led to that? How far and how deep can they go back into the psyche, or at least the understanding and perception of the psyche from the family, beyond the scope of returning for Thanksgiving and that time window right there?
I think the general rule, and the judge is probably going to make a prudent move on this, is that any questions would have to be limited in scope to the allegations themselves and the general time frame within which it's alleged that Koberger did this. Now, Koberger could open the door, however, to prior historical information, especially if they're running some kind of, you know, he was autistic, and so that's why he was stargazing or something. You know, the government could say, hey, you know, has he done this before? Can you tell us, you know, other instances where he's gone stargazing, or has that never happened? And you know, so the door can be open to that kind of thing. But as a general rule, I think the judge is going to keep it pretty tight to the scope of this trial, unless that door is open.
Yeah, I mean, does the autism argument open that door to some more speculation if it's brought up? Because I know it can't be used for, you know, showing a propensity to kill or not, but it's been talked about now. Can it be brought up in that context?
You know, I think it potentially can, especially if the defense is the first to offer information mm-hmm. about autism, that can potentially open the door. And then the prosecution can elicit facts that are inconsistent with what the defense is saying. They could say, hey, look, you know, he was a PhD student, right? He was pretty, you know, articulate and on top of things mentally. And you know, there's no prior erratic behavior of him, you know, standing outside at 3 a.m. when he's 7 years old looking at the stars, right? Like, you know, it just, they can use it to try to undermine some kind of autism or mental health argument defense makes.
So what I'm wondering here is if we're going to go and ask the family to testify and we're going beyond the scope of the trip back to Pennsylvania, and we go back to childhood, assuming that's when the diagnosis was made, if it was made, like, why? What happened here? What was he doing that made someone, you know, look at this? The one I'll go back to is, you know, I would hear this as a kid back in Wisconsin during the Dahmer days, because Dahmer was known to have been very cruel to animals and tortured them as a child. And any time, you know, boys are out doing things or whatever, we're like stepping on ant hills or whatnot. I my mom called me because I loved like messing with the ants in our yard. I was an only child. So this is what you do in Wisconsin when you have no one around you, you mess with the ant hills. So, and they didn't, my parents didn't like the ants. So I would, you know, pour water on them. My mom so lovingly would be like, it's like Jeffrey Dahmer. Like he was killing animals. And I'm like, it's ants. It's ants. Like, I'll do an ant farm next if you'd like, Mom. But, like, if there's something like that, if we find something where And this is nothing is out there of this. I'm just purely speculatively saying, if there was something like that where he was, you know, they found him torturing cats or whatever, and that's not out there. So don't anybody think I'm saying that. But if there is something like that, could that be brought into the trial of, look, he had the propensity to do this back then. We got him looked at. There turned out there was some sort of autism thing going on, an issue with empathy. Could that be brought in if it exists? Again, not saying it is, just purely speculative.
Hypothetically, if those events happen or something like that, I don't think they would see the light of the day in the courtroom during the guilt phase. Mm-hmm. I think the government would be downright silly to risk a reversal of a conviction based on, you know, prior alleged bad acts mm-hmm. with animal abuse or something,
yeah.
you know, whatever it is. And that would be foolish of them because cases are overturned on admission of prior bad acts all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
During the penalty phase, gosh, there are a lot less rules and things come in and, you know, do you talk about a history of violence for the person or mm-hmm. are you allowed to tell the jury about that? If such a history did exist, that one is questionable. It could go either way, I think. But certainly more information about prior historical stuff, including unsavory stuff, could come out at the penalty phase if we get that.
Because that's what I'm curious about, because not everything that's unsavory or bad acts necessarily means it was litigated ever or was ever in a courtroom. Sometimes it's just within the confines of a family, between those walls and what they knew about their kid growing up. And, you know, not necessarily crimes, but just there's something off here. And things like that. That's what I would be wondering, because it shows, you know, a pattern. It shows there's something way off with the autism thing. That's why I'm curious about the other thing. The big selfie, the selfie in the shower, the one we've talked about before, that it reminds me of Norman Bates and reminds me of American Psycho and Ted Bundy and a whole slew of others. The judge has not yet said if that's going to be admissible to court yet. The purpose of it is not to go down those roads. That's for us over here. It's for the bushy eyebrows, because that's the claim that one of the surviving roommates has made, that the bushy eyebrows, that's how I recognize who he was. And look, this next day in a picture, he's got the same bushy eyebrows. You can't argue that he didn't have bushy eyebrows then. Do you think this is going to get in? And if not, why?
I think it definitely comes in potentially at both phases for the reasons you said. You know, prosecution has to prove identity. They got to prove that Koberger did this. And there was that witness, the surviving roommate, who said the killer had bushy eyebrows. He has characteristically bushy eyebrows, and he had them the very next day. You know, appearances can change at trial. Things can be tempered, and person might not look exactly the same. So the prosecution is entitled to show, hey, the very next day, his appearance matched in part what the surviving witness said. And then, you know, the implications from that, especially at the death penalty phase, if he is convicted, show like a complete lack of remorse and detachment from the gravity mm-hmm. of how heinous these acts were. And so there it could really heat up at that second phase.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.